It's 8:58. Andy, what stories are you working on?
Number one, measles. Are you scared? They're even outlining what spots in town this person with the measles visited. McDonald's? My goodness, are you nervous? Are you going to rush out and get the vaccine in our 10 o'clock hour? I don't know how we snagged this guy, but we did. A Top Gun U.S. lawyer and health advocate talking about GMOs, aspartame, vaccines. We'll ask him about the measles scare.
Here's Andy Udman.
Is it dangerous for an adult to have measles?
Yes, it can be. Measles can be a very dangerous infection. It can cause pneumonia, it can cause ear infections, it can cause a brain infection, and in about 1 in 1,000 cases, it can actually be a fatal infection. And that's why we take measles very seriously, both because it can be a serious infection and also because it really spreads very easily. It can cause pneumonia, it can cause ear infections, it can cause a brain infection, and in about 1 in 1,000 cases, it can actually be a fatal infection. And that's why we take measles very seriously, both because it can be a serious infection and also because it really spreads very easily.
And this is a ploy. This is how the health officials justify their existence. This is how the vaccine industry sells their products, is predominantly to use fear.
Two very different points of view on this measles scare this morning. Which camp are you with? Are you concerned about the measles outbreak in London? This warning about how you may have been exposed and how measles can lead to death. My goodness, they're even listing the spots in London where this person with the measles visited. McDonald's on Hamilton Road back on Saturday. Walmart in the White Oaks Mall last weekend as well. Could this prompt you to rush out and get the measles vaccine, or is this fear-mongering to sell drugs? Good morning, London. It is Thursday, March the 20th. The show is London Today. My name is Andy Udman. Scary stuff. This list of where you may have been exposed to the measles, or as we say, is this fear-mongering? We'll hear from the health unit and then open up the phones to your thoughts for all points of view. In our 10 o'clock hour, our regular Thursday health segment, Top Gun American lawyer Jim Turner, one of Ralph Nader's Raiders, opens fire on vaccines. We'll ask him about the measles scare. On aspartame, on fluoride, on GMOs. You do not want to miss our 10 o'clock hour this morning with Top Gun American lawyer and health advocate Jim Turner, along with Pam Colleen. But first off this morning, the measles. The debate about vaccines. I feel so badly for parents today of young children, because I know so many of them who are so torn by the warnings from the health unit about, you got to get this vaccine. You got to get this vaccine or your children will die. And now this scare about the measles. You got to get this vaccine or you may die. In fact, if you were at McDonald's last week on Hamilton Road, you could die. Literally, that's what Brian Warshawski is saying. You could die. Okay, I want to have a full discussion on this. And so what we're going to do, I want to play you first our interview with Dr. Bryna Warshawski, the Associate Medical Officer of Health for the Middlesex London Health Unit. Have her point of view, and then I want to hear from you, and we'll hear from Pam Colleen, who has quite a different point of view. So first, again, in the name of everybody gets their say, here's the health unit's Dr. Bryna Warshawski in conversation this morning with Steve Garrison.
Well, what seems to be happening is that there is measles in other parts of the world, and measles is a very highly infectious disease. Most people are vaccinated, and that's good, but the vaccine isn't always perfect, and there are some people who are unvaccinated. And so people are importing the virus from other parts of the world where they're exposed, and then that on occasion leads to local spread within the communities, and we're seeing that happen in various communities across the country, and that's been the case here as well. We've had an imported case, and then we have a possible second case in someone who has had close contact with that imported case.
So let's just run through the symptoms, Doctor.
Sure. So the symptoms can start off like a cold. They can look a bit nonspecific at the beginning. So it would be a fever, a cough, a runny nose, runny eyes. Some people have like irritated runny eyes. There can be some sores in the mouth, but people may not notice that. And then about 2 to 4 days after those sort of nonspecific symptoms start, this rash starts. And the rash generally starts on the face. It can be sort of flat with some bumps, and then it progresses down the body.
Dr. Bryan, I'm going to run through some of the locations and times of possible
exposure. Okay, we'll drop the interview there because basically, in a nutshell, Steve Garrison just ran down the locations that they're actually warning people about. But they're saying if you were at McDonald's, for example, on Hamilton Road last Saturday from 2:15 to 6 p.m., you may have been exposed. If you were at Walmart in the White Oaks Mall last Saturday from 7:30 p.m. to after closing, you may have been exposed. If you were at Best Buy from last Saturday from 8:30 to after closing, you may have been exposed. Future Shop. And the list goes on and on. I don't ever recall seeing a list like this where if you were there, you may have been exposed. So I'm asking you this morning, we're opening up the phone line, 643-1290. Which camp are you in? The camp that says, if you were at McDonald's, you better rush out and get a vaccine. You better watch right now for, wait a minute, when I was a kid, we used to go to what they called measles party. One kid got the measles. Everybody went there so they'd get the measles so they'd get it over with. Now, the difference here is this is adults we're talking about. But is this a genuine health concern or is there room for another argument which says it's just fear-mongering? And I just want to, for a moment or two, bring in our nutrition and health consultant, Pam Colleen, who will be joining us next hour. She always does on Thursday. Pam, what do you make of this latest warning from the health unit, complete with warnings about if you were at this location, then we need to talk to you?
So if you touch money, if you touch doorknobs, if you touch handrails anywhere, right, you're going to be exposed to pathogens. They're all around us, Andy. And I don't see people dying in the streets right now. So it's a lot of fear-mongering. It's a huge exaggeration. When I was a kid, it was very normal to get things like measles. It wasn't a death-defying experience. It's part of basically building your immune system. And unfortunately, if you look back at history, the vaccine industry took credit for something that they were not responsible for, and that was the reduction in things like measles. When you look at history, you see that it was the improvement of sanitation and hygiene that actually decreased the incidence of infectious diseases. So as you look at some of these researchers who've done this, who've compiled this research, you'll see that things like measles were already on their way out before vaccines even hit the market. So it's the improvement of sanitation and hygiene that are essentially behind the reduction in infectious diseases.
Okay, now, Pam, you'll understand if I say this, for the sake of our management, as you often hear, the views of our guests do not necessarily represent the views of this radio station, and we stress that Pam is out there on her own. But, Pam, would you not then be accused of exposing people to a health risk by suggesting they don't need to rush out and get this vaccine?
It's a free market out there, right? We live in a capitalistic economy. If people want to inject themselves with this vaccine, it is their choice. But they shouldn't have any false hope. And that's what bothers me the most, is that they're being essentially told that vaccines in general, not just the measles vaccine, but vaccines in general are going to make us healthier as a society. And I just don't see that happening.
Okay, so what are you saying to people who are this morning nervous, especially when the health unit comes on and starts listing, you know, places like, I'm just going to go through the list, a long list on their website. You can go and check it yourself, folks. McDonald's on Hamilton Road, Walmart on in the White Oaks Mall, Best Buy on Wellington Road, Future Shop on Wellington Road, Silver City Theater at Masonville Place, Value Village in the south end of the city. Even the London Health Sciences Center, Victoria Campus Emergency Department, Tim Hortons, commissioners, and I mean, those
are
high traffic.
Afraid, Andy, if people are afraid, they should do these two things. Number one, stay home. Don't go out, because when you go out, you're going to expose yourself to potentially thousands of different pathogens, you know, viruses, bacteria, whatever. So they're all around us. Like I said, even if you touch money, if you touch handrails, if you touch doorknobs, you know, if you stand close to somebody who may be infected, I mean, don't go out. Or you can do something else, and that is you can actually do things naturally to build your immune system. And the World Health Organization has been pushing lately, and it's not been a recent announcement because the World Health Organization has been warning us about the damaging health effects of eating too much sugar. So one of the things, even according to the World Health Organization, that people can do to help support their health is to reduce things like sugar in their diet. I wish the health unit would come forward on this issue and put out more warnings about how detrimental it is to consume sugar. And instead of doing that, unfortunately, they're telling us that we need to inject our bodies with chemicals and that somehow miraculously this is going to cause us to be healthier as a society. So I think we need to be pragmatic here. I think consumers need to take the bull by the horns and start a grassroots effort to do more in order to help themselves improve their health. As Dr. John Abramson said a couple of weeks ago on the show that we did, 70% of your health is in your own hands. It's through the choices that you're making. And unfortunately, people aren't being told the correct information in terms of what they can do to improve their own health.
Okay, now we called you from your home and you have to scoot so you can get to the radio station for our 10 o'clock hour. Now, we're talking to, I don't know how you ever got this guy booked, but Jim Turner. Who is he and what are the four things that we're going to focus on?
Jim Turner is a lawyer and he's the head of a group called Citizens for Health. And for many, many years, he's been advocating for consumers in terms of doing what he can legally to protect us from the many chemicals that we're being exposed to in society. So he started off essentially by stopping the release of things like aspartame on the market. Actually, he was part of that effort legally to stop aspartame from hitting the market. And unfortunately, the company that manufactured aspartame ended up winning out and the courts overruled that decision. So now, unfortunately, we're being slowly poisoned by things like aspartame on the marketplace. And then he's also working on efforts in and around genetically modified foods. He knows about the toxicity of adding artificial fluoride to our water supply. He works on many, many different efforts to warn consumers on the one hand and at the same time legally working to protect us from these chemicals.
Okay. Pam Killeen, we thank you for your time. We'll see you at 10.
Thanks, Andy.
Okay, terrific. Okay, so that's in our next hour. I don't know how we managed this interview. Top Gun American lawyer Jim Turner talking about GMOs, about aspartame, about fluoride, processed food, and so much more. Okay, your thoughts on this measles scare, 643-1290. Do you think what you're hearing from the Middlesex London Health Unit is entirely warranted, that we should all be very alarmed about the possibility of getting measles? We should immediately watch for symptoms. We should carefully go through this list to see if we might have been exposed at McDonald's, at Tim Hortons, at the White Oaks Mall. Are you buying into the scare? 643-1290. The lines are open. Back with your calls in just a moment. Right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK.
Is it dangerous for an adult to have measles?
Yes, it can be. Measles can be a very dangerous infection. It can cause pneumonia. It can cause ear infections. It can cause a brain infection. And in about 1 in 1,000 cases, it can actually be a fatal infection. And that's why we take measles very seriously, both because it can be a serious infection and also because it really spreads very easily.
And this is a ploy. This is how the health officials justify their existence. This is how the vaccine industry sells their products, is predominantly to use fear.
8 minutes now after 10 o'clock, and it is Thursday morning, and that means Pam Killeen is in the house. But more importantly, important health issues are on the table. Have you ever noticed there are certain words that no matter what conversation you're having with people, whether it be at Tim Hortons or at your kitchen table or at a cocktail party, you just say the word. You just say the word, and instantly you have a debate, whether it's religion or abortion, or they're just certain words. Here are some words which are high on that list. Instantly you have a debate. GMOs, aspartame, vaccine, processed foods, all related to health. Trans fats is another. Good morning, Pam Killeen. You're ready to rock and roll?
I sure am, Andy. How are you today?
Well, I'm very good. Thank you for the earlier segment last hour about vaccines. And I thought we'd start there this morning because our guest this morning, again, I don't know how you land these people, Jim Turner, hotshot American lawyer, who's not only a lawyer but a health advocate who does not hold back. And he used a word this morning. I was watching his videos, morality.
Morality.
That's a new word to me in the context of health. What is morality, Pam?
Well, essentially, and you and I are wondering is how on earth we can be subjected to so many incredibly toxic ingredients and under the umbrella, of course, of allegedly making us healthy. It's just immoral.
Anyway, let's start with vaccines. I want to talk about vaccines and then all the other issues that we just mentioned, but vaccines is the topic du jour after that warning from the health unit in London, the Middlesex London Health Unit, even listing all those places where you may have been exposed to someone with the measles, McDonald's, Tim Hortons, the White Oaks Mall. But I want to get right to Jim Turner. Would you introduce our guest this morning?
Well, we're honored this morning to have Jim Turner with us. He's the president and founder of Citizens for Health, a health advocacy group out of Washington, D.C. Good morning, Jim. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Just want to correct one thing. I'm not the founder. There were founders of which I was a supporter. And then very shortly after that, got on the board and then became chair.
Wonderful.
Probably the bigger question people are asking this morning, Jim Turner, is, wait a minute, lawyer? A lawyer using the word morality? Please explain.
Let me be very, very specific about what I said when I used the word morality. I believe it is profoundly immoral to have a product on the market which is required to be utilized by children, knowing that some of those children will die as a direct result of that product or be maimed for life, and then to solve that problem by setting up a compensation program to pay their families. I believe saying you must take this vaccine, and I know that some of you will die as a result of that, and the way we'll handle that is to pay you money. I believe that is a profoundly immoral public policy.
Right now at the health unit in London, they are rolling their eyes, practically falling off their chairs, saying that guy, because of guys like him, people are going to die. So let's flip the argument back to him. Because of him, some people are not going to get their measles vaccine, and somebody could die.
The issue of whether or not a person takes a vaccine is a decision that that person and that person's family should make. It does entail some risk, but the law is very, very clear that you are not permitted to mandate a vaccine unless there is an imminent danger. That's what all the cases have held. The bureaucrats in the health departments across the country and across Canada have systematically exceeded their authority. That issue will come to a head at some point. It's very, very important to understand that my point about morality is to say, don't require people to take a vaccine knowing that it's going to kill some of them. That is improper. What we should be doing, if we are going to use vaccines at all, is we should be working with all of our energy and effort to make sure that there are no side effects to vaccines. And to the extent that there are side effects to vaccines, then we need to play them off against the benefits. And the vast majority of people are not going to be exposed to diseases that will cause them death if they are not vaccinated,
okay.
The vast, vast majority.
Let's start with the debate that we're having in London this morning. There are people who are hearing Pam Colleen on the one hand and the health unit on the other hand on the issues of a vaccine for measles. What would your advice be, Jim Turner?
Well, I can tell you what should be done on measles, and I can tell you what happened when we proposed it. The fact of the matter is that people can receive measles, encountering the measles disease and getting it create a natural immunity to the measles. They will create circulating antibody to measles, and they will be protected for life from having gotten the measles and had the experience. What happens then is many of those people then get vaccinated, and there is a serious side effect from vaccinating people who have circulating antibodies. So there's a disease called subacute sclerosing panencephalitis. Very rare, but in almost 100% of the cases, it's people who have circulating measles antibody from having encountered the measles and then received a vaccine. What we proposed was that people be tested to see if they have circulating measles antibody before they get the measles vaccine. That was rejected because it was too administratively difficult to do. So the result was, because it was too administratively difficult to do that, we would go ahead and vaccinate everyone, knowing that some of them, a small number, of course, some of them would die. And the way we would handle that is we would pay a compensation. I'm saying that's immoral. That is the capability of preventing all of those deaths and all of the side effects is present, but too expensive, too difficult, not going to be used. Instead, we'll give it to everybody, knowing some will die, and then we will compensate them.
Oh, my God.
That is stunning.
That is what I call immoral.
It is.
What you said, a small number will die. Do you have a percentage?
Very, very small. You know, probably
But it would seem to me that if it saved one life, it would be worth doing.
Well, it isn't. It, you know, I don't even think of it as one life per se. I mean, it's a moral dilemma, which I firmly come down on the side of one. One person's life. You know, they always say in these tests, in these scientific discussions, that one person's experience is an anecdote, but one person's experience to that person is everything. And it's when you say save one person's life, you need to recognize that a child's life and anyone else's life, for that matter, but particularly a child's life, is in a web of relationships that affect everyone that comes into their framework. It affects the parents. It affects the school teachers. It affects the children. So when a child dies from, and by the way, they like to cover up that they died from the vaccine, but when a child dies as a result of a vaccine injury, it's a huge web of a problem that's generated, not just one life, but more. And I want to be very clear so you understand. The United States government has a compensation program that has paid over $2 billion to families who have lost a child and it's almost always children, in the vaccine program. That's over $2 billion. And this program was cynically developed back in the 1980s in order to stop the flood of lawsuits that was emerging against side effects from vaccines. Basically, they cut off the notion that you could go to court and get vindicated, which is one of the prime ways that you hold a company responsible. And they just built into their process a cost of doing business. So for every vaccine that's sold, about a nickel goes into this fund that compensates children who are killed or maimed by the vaccines. Again, that's what I meant when I used the word immoral.
Mm-hmm. Vaccines for other diseases. Your thoughts?
I started my review of vaccines in 1970 at the request of John Gardner, the former Secretary of Health and Human Services, Health Education and Welfare at the time, here in this country. And I looked at every single vaccine with senior vaccine officials in the U.S. government and scientists outside. Every single vaccine has a risk-benefit ratio to it. That is, every one of them carries risks, and every one of them has benefits. They are not evaluated on a risk-benefit basis, vaccine by vaccine. Rather, there is a broad policy adopted which says all vaccines should be given to all children at all times, and they're now trying to expand that to adults. The problem with that is multifaceted. For example, the vaccines that children now get between the age of the day of birth, they get their first vaccine in this country, and 5 years, they're subjected to about 70 different agents that are injected as vaccines. These 70 agents are going into an immature immune system. The immune system is designed to protect the individual. The theory of vaccination is to help the immune system. But when you take it and put it into the babies are born today, and in many, many hospitals in this country are immediately given one vaccine. Then gradually over the next 5 years, they're given more and more and more. We are putting the vaccines into children at a time when their immune system has not yet developed and able to actually take advantage of the benefits of the vaccine, certainly not the full advantage. And at the same time, they are at the most vulnerable to the agents that are in the vaccines. So let's just say, it seems to me that the issue is we want a sound vaccine policy in which people are able to get the full benefits of vaccines and none of the side effects.
If you had to choose between your child having all the vaccines or none, which would you go?
None. I had two children, and I did have to choose. And we went and we got a pediatrician, and we walked through each one of the vaccines one by one. Our measles vaccine, for example, was flown in from Canada because the United States regulation of a measles vaccine was shoddy. It was then and still is. Ours was grown in a human cell substrate. Our pediatrician said we don't want to do that. Now there's a huge argument about animal substrates as well. Remember, these vaccines are created in a medium that is filled with all kinds of extraneous materials. They are not clean. They are not pristine. And these are other areas where we should be actually looking. The point is a relatively simple point. Vaccines have a risk-benefit trade-off, and it is a costly approach to sort out how best to use vaccines. And the government does not want to spend the money to sort out vaccine by vaccine. So if for example, if you were to give all vaccines, cholera vaccine is not a useful vaccine. It disguises the disease and creates problems. Many governments have recognized that. I would not take a cholera vaccine. And there are instances where it may be mandated for travel, but in many cases, it's no longer mandated for travel.
So because we have to take a break in just a moment, let's make the good and bad list when it comes to vaccines. What are the worst? I'm thinking one of them that might be on the list, the Tamiflu vaccine.
Yeah, so that's an antiviral, Andy.
The Tamiflu is a drug, but the flu vaccine is I don't take the flu vaccine. My family doesn't. We don't believe that it's a sound thing to do. I talked to the founder of CDC when we were doing our research. He said he was actually fired from his job because he would not recommend the flu vaccine. The flu vaccine is not a sound health approach at all. Period. It just is not. Shouldn't take it.
Okay. Others on the bad list?
Well, I don't, I'm cautious about good and bad. What I'd like to say is what the trade-offs are. I can give you a feel for that. The old pertussis vaccine was definitely a very high risk versus benefit trade-off, many, many more risks than benefits. I worked with people at the Division of Biologic Standards, which preceded the FDA, as the regulator who regulated that vaccine and said it's the dirtiest thing that ever went into a human being. From 1935 till the mid-90s, that was the vaccine. They wouldn't change it. Finally, it was changed to a better vaccine so that the trade-off is a better trade-off now. Still, I would want to sit down right now very carefully with a sympathetic pediatrician and ask them about this. What is this a good idea or not a good idea to take? I'm trying to think this through there. Each one of them has a difficult problem which needs to be overcome. And the main point that I would make is that I would avoid all vaccines until there is some kind of a finding that there is a threat. One of the things you want to do in a population is build up natural immunity. It's very, very important to build up natural immunity. And so what you want to have is if there's not a threat around, you want people to develop the immunity naturally. The vaccine can be very valuable in breaking something that is moving across the country or the world. Now, the second problem that comes up with is, first of all, we can have the abstract discussion about policy. But the second problem that comes up is how the policy is implemented. In the last round on flu, there was lots of manipulation of the information so that people were misled into what was actually going on.
Okay, we do have to take a short break when we come back. Here's another hand grenade when it comes to discussions about health. GMOs. We'll be back with Jim Turner and Pam Kalina in just a moment right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK. We are laying rubber on the pavement this morning when it comes to health issues. Believe me, we've just discussed vaccines and now we're going to move to GMOs. Andy Udman along with Pam Kalina and our guest this morning, Top Gun American lawyer Jim Turner, one of Ralph Nader's raiders. And we're going to ask him about GMOs, but I want to ask a more general question, Jim, if I could. What is the most pressing and most threatening issue right now when it comes to our health and our budgets related to health in the United States and Canada?
Quality of the food supply. Mm-hmm. We have debased the quality of the food supply systematically for the last 20, 30, 40 years. We do not now have the level of nutrition, of quality, of access to food generally across the board that we had in 1970. We have had some positives in that regard with the advent of the organic food movement and the natural food stores that have presented essentially an alternative to the mainstream food supply. And that's starting to reach its way into a mainstream stores as well. But we have done way too much pesticide work. We've done way too much in the way of added colors, flavors, and other functional items, extenders, and so forth, so that we have a situation now where we have products on the market that we think are one thing, which in fact are something quite different than they were originally created to be.
And that ties into the GMO story. I know you're working on it with the Citizens for Health. Where do you stand right now with your efforts?
Well, the GMOs, I want to start with one overarching fact, or one overarching position that touches vaccines, GMOs, and everything else we're talking about, and that is we need to start with the premise, which I believe in and underlies everything I do, which is people are smart. They understand exactly the kinds of choices that they have to make. What they lack is, A, the information to make the choices that they need to make, and, B, they lack the time and effort to fight their way through the maze of stuff that's thrown up in their way to find the answers to questions. So our issue on GMOs from 1994, when we participated in an effort, they got a million signatures to Congress here to label GMOs, is that we need people to know which foods are GMOs and which aren't, and we need to have the entire society involved in that discussion by being able to put their dollars down for things that they want. And if they want GMOs, I am not opposed to people buying GMOs as long as they understand what the trade-off is. I am pretty confident, and the polling shows, that once people understand what GMOs are about, they will shy away from buying them whenever they can.
And one of the risks, of course, is that there could be some negative health consequences associated with GMOs. There has been research that has been published that suggests this.
Yeah, and I would argue that personally, as a matter of choice for myself, I believe that the science is quite persuasive that there is a huge risk that isn't worth taking for the benefits that come from GMOs.
Huge risk of what?
First of all, when I just let me underscore risk as the issue there, and let me give you two examples. For example, the Roundup Ready products that are the seeds that are put on the market, those seeds are made to defend against Roundup Ready, so that they will then survive. The plants will survive, but the weeds will be killed. And what that's doing is creating a larger dose of actual pesticide being allowed to be put on the products. That puts more chemicals into the food supply, and we are increasingly concerned, just generally, when I say we, the society at large, is increasingly concerned about how the chemicals in food contribute to various kinds of diseases, including cancer, heart disease, and stroke, the ones that are the number three, one, two, and three of the major killers and disablers in the society.
Now, in Europe, GMOs are labeled, so consumers have the opportunity to make a choice. But in North America, they keep avoiding this issue.
Yeah, and what's most cynical about that is that the very same companies that put products in Europe labeled with GMO claim that it's not possible to label them in the U.S., that are in the U.S. and Canada. And that's just cynicism. It's perfectly easy to label them, and they just don't want to do it.
I'm trying to follow the logic of that. Why is it possible in Europe but not in North America?
Because the Europeans adopted laws that said you have to do it, so they have to do it. A smart corporate leader would say, I have to do it in Europe. Why don't I save the money and just print a bunch of labels that have it on and not have different labels for both kinds of products?
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing different about the product, but the place it's sold is different, so we have to have a different label. In the U.S., they make that claim all the time. If a state adopts a restriction on a food label of some kind, says you must say X, they'll step in and say the federal government says no, they all have to be the same. But on the world stage, they're very, very happy to have them be different.
But you mentioned polls, and over 80% of the population, when polled, wants labeling.
That's correct. And we believe that what we have here is the thwarting of the interest of the public in getting the information they need to make the choices they want to make.
Everybody knows to make a golf ball fly, you have to hit the sweet spot. We know we're about to hit your sweet spot when we mention the word aspartame. Go for it.
All aspartame is a prime example. We picked it in 1970 as an issue because it was clearly combining all of the kinds of issues we were concerned about. Being an activist, you have to measure your victories the way you can. We kept aspartame off the market for 11 years by legal activity, pointing out that it wasn't shown to be safe. And we got a ruling from a public board of inquiry at the FDA that it had not been shown to be safe. But Donald Rumsfeld, who's president of the company that manufactured Cyril at the Cyril, the company that manufactured aspartame at that time, was on the President Reagan's transition team, manipulated a guy into the position of commissioner of the FDA, who then overruled the public board of inquiry and allowed it on the market. But our big victory was that they thought that they were going to have a $7 billion a year sweetener product that was going to actually begin to supplant sugar. Actually, it's never exceeded more than about $2 billion, maybe a little more than that. So we feel that we cut into their market significantly, and most Americans don't use it. There about 100 million people use it, and the rest tend to avoid it. And when I say use it, I mean just regularly use it.
But obviously, that's still 100 million.
By accident, because they don't know it's there, because it's in over 5,000 products now.
Yes.
But it's not been the success that they thought it was. Monsanto finally sold it to another group of folks, and they split up into two separate companies, and they're working away at a nice market, you know, a couple billion-dollar market. It's not bad, but that's small business compared to the large multinationals.
Pam makes the point. That's still a lot of people using aspartame if it's in 5,000 products. What are the health risks directly associated with aspartame?
Well, the main issue is does it or does it not contribute to brain tumors? The evidence is so strong that it probably does that I don't think it should be on the market for that reason. But setting aside whether it should or shouldn't be definitely on the market by virtue of the science, clearly anybody who knew all of the information about the relationship between brain tumors and NutraSweet, it's NutraSweet's the brand name, if they knew the relationship, they would work to avoid it. When NutraSweet was put on the market in soft drinks in 1982, subsequent to that, the number of glioblastomas went up by about 10%. It leveled off at that point, largely because the people that were increasing their use of NutraSweet were people who had already used it. But the presence of those glioblastomas is a significant factor in making a public policy decision. For example, there's a good chance that the glioblastoma that Teddy Kennedy died from might be related to his wide consumption of diet sodas. I'm not arguing that it is, but I'm saying that it's enough of a possibility that it adds up to my reasons for staying away from it.
Okay, now let's look at draw the camera back a little and look at the overall health, the state of health of, let's just say Americans. You're an American and you know your country best. We're not far behind on any of the issues. What's the single biggest health issue in the United States today?
Well, first of all, understand the United States ranks 35th in the world by the World Health Organization on the quality of its health care. And it is the most expensive per capita health care system in the world. It is twice as much as the next one, which varies between Switzerland and Sweden. But we spend twice as much per capita on individual health, and we are 35th in the world. We're over 25th in life expectancy. We're about 30th we're actually 41st in maternal deaths. That's deaths at birth by mothers. We have a very, very bad health care system and health care statistics. Now, when you say what's the worst problem, I mean, we've got deaths from heart disease, which is a major problem. And then cancer. These are serious health problems. All of them have some diet-related component to them. So that my argument from the beginning has been we should really be seriously looking at our food supply, examining it, and understand how to improve it so that it can actually be a contributor to health rather than a drag on health.
Now, you've been recently featured in the New York Times talking about another one of your efforts with Citizens for Health, and that is the issue of high fructose corn syrup. Can you tie that into the story of chronic disease?
Well, high fructose corn syrup came on the market in just roughly arbitrarily, just picked 1980. It actually was around a little bit before that, but not a major player in the market. And then from 1980, it had a major growth in the amount of sales, huge sales. Simultaneously to that, the sales of the incidence of diabetes and obesity went up in a graph that's almost exactly identical to high fructose corn syrup. At a certain point, there were some studies put out in 2005 that drew attention to this fact and said there seems to be a correlation, and we should look at this as a problem. And high fructose corn syrup sales started going down. They're only sold to the food industry, but then the food products put them on the label, and people stopped buying products that had them on the label. When those sales started going down, the high fructose corn industry decided to their job was, what they wanted to do was to change the name of high fructose corn syrup to corn sugar. We at Citizens for Health opposed that, and the sugar industry opposed that. And we went to the sugar industry and said, look, if we work together, we might actually be able to raise the public's attention and get something done that will be positive. And in fact, that worked out to be quite a positive alliance, because the petition of the high fructose corn people to the FDA to change their name to corn sugar was rejected by the FDA in a really what would be called a stinging rebuke if the newspapers ever covered it. What they do is just a simple little short story saying it was rejected. But the agency wrote a very tough message to the corn folks. Now, they've turned around and tried everything they can to make everybody think that there's a thing called sugary, which includes high fructose corn syrup and sugar. But they're just wrong. It's just wrong. Sugar consumption per capita in the United States today is essentially identical to what it was in 1909 to now, per capita consumption of sugar has remained essentially constant. We did not have obesity, and we did not have diabetes the way that we do now in 1909, or in fact all the way up to 1980. Only after 1980, when HFCS came into the market, did it start going up. And so we are working very closely with sugar to get it out to the public. Again, information to the public. Understand what this is all about. If you know all these facts and you want to buy HFCS, more power to you. Our position is, we believe really strongly, if people knew the facts about HFCS, they would not buy it.
But the industry buys their own science, and this is what can get down to the consumer. They're not getting the correct information. The information that they are getting is heavily compromised because industry's paying for it.
First of all, that's absolutely correct. But second of all, in the HFCS case, there is no science that establishes that it's safe. When you look at the information they cite, forget the fact that the science is paid for by the corn folks. Just given that, even that science doesn't withstand the scrutiny that any intelligent person would put on it. Let me give you an example. The high fructose corn syrup people made the argument that their data showed that there was no difference between high fructose corn syrup and sugar when they were arguing to the FDA. However, when they wanted high fructose corn syrup to be introduced into Mexico, they used the exact same science to argue that they were completely different, that sugar and high fructose corn syrup were different. The corn industry used the same data in one forum to prove that they were the same and in another forum to prove that they were different. So first of all, I agree with you that they buy the science. But secondly, I would argue to you that the cynicism of their manipulation does, in fact, encroach on the question of morality. How you can take science, even though you've paid for it, and use it one way in one form and another way in another form and call that honest is beyond me.
Some would say they're trying to suck and blow at the same time. Listen, one of the big issues in the world right now, even as we speak, is Putin in Russia. What a crook, what a slimy guy, making all his friends rich. But your story about Donald Rumsfeld, I am still chewing that one over. What an incredible story of someone lining the pockets of his friends and doing a nasty on the public health at the same time. So the question is this, in terms of the crises that we have in our health situation in North America, whether it be heart disease, whether it be cancer, whether it be obesity and all the related diseases, what group, what industry, what people are most responsible?
Let me just say one thing quickly on Putin. There's a great article in the New York Times today that's worth reading by the former mayor of Moscow, really tearing apart the entire thing that's going on there. I think it's worth taking a look at. But let me move on. I just did that because you mentioned it. But let me move on and say there's a the problem that the issue that we've been trying to highlight both at Citizens for Health and in our law practice is that we're in a matrix of interlocking interests. And our argument is not so much that it's us against them as it's us and them against it. I have many, many allies, friends, supporters, and people who I have great confidence in who are in the food industry. Many of them are fighting huge battles inside the food industry on the very side that we're on, trying to create better products, keeping crap out of the food, and so forth. They are there and working at it. And we have spent many, many, many hours over the last 25 years in meetings with people inside the food industry trying to clean it up. However, you have a situation where, let's just take high fructose corn syrup because I think the sweetener world and sweeteners in general are a good example. The issue for the corn industry is how do we keep making money off our product? So they've come up with a bunch of things. One of them was the corn-based fuel. That's not going very well. They're having a lot of difficulty there. But they've got huge government supports for that, and that's helping prop up the corn prices. There is on the additional fact is that they have an industrial factory that produces high fructose corn syrup. That's about 5% of the corn industry's income. But they build this thing as an industrial product into the system for its monetary purposes. Now, if I were to get to the heart of what's actually shifting things, when you look at the GMOs, for example, high fructose corn syrup, pretty much all the additives that go into food, they are used to create financial flows for the people who are the secondary suppliers to the food industry. In many, many, many ways, the food industry is itself a victim of what's going on. And that problem is something we need to know in order to move forward and solve our situation.
Okay, we do have to take a short break. When we come back, as Pam and I still have several items we want to ask you about. We have talked about vaccines, GMOs, aspartame, high fructose corn syrup. We want to move to several issues, including one we're having a big debate on in this city, as we are in cities around the world, fluoride. We'll be back in just a moment with Pam Colleen and Jim Turner, the president of Citizens for Health. When we come back in just a moment, right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK. Boy, if you've been taking notes on this hour, you've got hand cramps big time because we have had so much information from Jim Turner, the president of Citizens for Health. I mean, what a passionate advocate he is for health, and he's a lawyer, Pam.
Well, he's been on this boat for a long, long time. Like you said, he started working on the aspartame issue in and around 1970. So he's been watching these poisons, these toxins get into our food supply for many, many years, and he's been advocating and doing what he can to help us.
So much territory to cover. Now, what we haven't covered yet is water. We're having a big debate in this city, and I suspect it'll be a big one in the next election. It's a debate they're having around the world. Fluoride. Jim Turner, your thoughts on fluoride in the water?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of really good information that's been put out by fluoride. You can just Google it and find it. And it is not something you would want to have in your water supply. But let's set aside the question of fluoride for a moment. And even if you're having a debate there or in any city that's having debate, one of the really interesting questions in the place I focus my attention and our Citizens for Health attention is that in virtually every city where they're claiming to put fluoride in the water, they're actually putting an acid of fluoride, a byproduct from the pesticide industry and the aluminum industry, not actual fluoride. So let's just say there's a debate about fluoride. You can go either way on that, perhaps. I personally think it's not a good idea for putting in the water supply. But that's a separate issue from what they're actually doing, which is they're putting a product in the supply that's not in the water supply that's not fluoride. I think that in your city, people should ask, what is it? What are you putting in here? Is it really actual commercial grade pure fluoride, or is it this debased acid that comes off of the spraying of plants? What they do is it's illegal for it to go into the water supply as a pollutant under EPA, so they collect it up, and then they put it in, they concentrate it, and then they sell it to cities to put in the water supply, bypassing the natural water supply.
Well, there's some brilliant marketing going on there. If you can take a poison, put it in big barrels, got the cross and bones on it, and sell it to cities for $1 million a year, I mean, that's some brilliant marketing.
That's the issue that should be the focus of the battle going on at the city level, because they are not actually, there's not enough actual pure fluoride to fluoride the entire world, entire world's food supply, water supply. So they use this other stuff. I mean, I don't. That's not why they use it, because there's not enough fluoride. They use it because that's the way they get rid of the waste. And it's a very, again, you know, if you have the information, it's not that hard to know what to do.
But you mentioned earlier, too, about high fructose corn syrup and how there aren't any safety studies. The same thing goes with fluoride. There are no safety studies ever been published to show that it's safe.
Well, I didn't, I want to be very clear. Mm-hmm. I did not say there weren't safety studies. What I'm saying is that the safety studies that exist have been paid for by industry and are dubious at best. So that's the same in fluoride. But there's no body of evidence that would establish the safety of these things. None. Of fluoride. There's just none, particularly this acidic byproduct. The fluoride itself is problematic. I object to its being in the water supply for personal rights reasons. I don't think anybody should be forced to consume anything that they don't want to consume. It's funny. The public, you know, reacts very, very strongly in the marketplace on this. When they started putting fluoride in the water, we didn't have a bottled water industry. But the corn people like to point out that since 1980, we've had an increase in the sales of bottled water that has sort of paralleled that of high fructose corn syrup. They're kind of with a wink saying maybe that's what's causing the obesity.
Now, you have another initiative which involves bottled water, and that has to do with the flavorings in bottled water. So I think a lot of consumers aren't really aware of what these flavorings consist of.
You don't want to consume the additives that are going into the flavored water. the whole way that FDA regulates flavors is really laughable.
Come on, Jim, what are they putting in our bottled water? Go for it.
I don't have anything specific that I have to say about water, bottled water at this point, flavored water. I'm just saying, just in general, don't buy flavored water. Regular water is better.
Stomp and Tom Connors had a song called Bugs, Bugs, Bugs. They should put them all in jugs. Are we getting close?
Well, yeah, there's a whole campaign to put these grind up these little bugs, and they're actually colorings, and put them in all kinds of drinks and foods and so forth. And frankly, from my perspective, that's an open debate. I don't know whether that's a bad thing or a good thing. What I don't like is they're hiding it. They're hiding it, and they won't tell you, and they say they won't tell you.
Okay.
And that, to me, every time I see that, I get very, very nervous.
We have about,
away from it.
We have about 2 minutes left. I just want to ask you about, if you ask most people, what's the biggest health issue in North America today, they would say obesity. Your comments. And we're going to sue somebody for getting us into this the horrible crisis we're in when it comes to the fact that 25 to 30, 35% of North Americans are obese. Who would we sue?
I'll tell you, if I was going to, there's already a lawsuit in upstate New York suing high fructose corn syrup on that very issue, diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very interesting. One of the main advocates of the idea that HFCS and sugar are identical, identified in the public, Dr. Lustig, has actually filed an affidavit in that lawsuit saying they aren't identical. The main reason is that they're putting more fructose in the high fructose corn syrup than there is in sugar. So there is a lawsuit already going, and they're suing them, and we'll see what happens. It's a one man lawsuit. You know, he's got a child that was made ill, they believe, by high fructose corn syrup, and they're fighting a lawsuit. What he's asking is that other lawyers across the country do the same thing.
There's a tsunami of products, though, that are challenging our health. We've talked about several. There's another one that is big, and it's been in the news a lot lately, and that has to do with the trans fat issue as well. I mean, what's the government going to do? What's the food industry going to do now that we know just how incredibly toxic these trans fats are?
Well, the FDA actually has now started a movement to get rid of trans fats. I mean, it's kind of interesting. Our side of the argument is that they could be doing more and faster. But They are at least on the side of removing trans fats, and they're moving them in the direction of getting rid of them. We're a little bit concerned about the fact that they're remaining, and they're a bit disguised, but still, there is movement to get rid of trans fats.
Jim Turner, we're almost out of time. Let's make it really simple. What are you having for lunch, and what are you not having for lunch?
I always bring my own lunch, and generally speaking, it's green beans, carrots, and some good meat. And you know, we get we have a nice farm out here that we buy locally, and we'll have water as our drink. And actually, it's really quite good.
Yeah, sounds really healthy.
I do not believe in not eating good. You know, not eating things that I like. I like the things I eat. But I can like things that I eat that are also healthy.
Okay. Now, Jim's website, by the way, for listeners, is citizens.org, and his law firm website is swanken-turner.com, swanken-turner.com. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jim.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Okay, Tim, you've been amazing. Thank you so much.
And this weekend, Andy, I'm going to be getting a booth at the Women's Lifestyle Show at the convention center. So Saturday and Sunday, I'll be at
the Women's Lifestyle Show. The signs are all over town, and you're going to be there.
I'm going to be there at booth number 17 at 11 o'clock in the morning. I'm going to do a short presentation at the small stage about environmental toxins. So I'll be launching a new product line, a natural skincare product line at the actual show.
Awesome. Wow. Mm-hmm. And a reminder, you can always go to Pam Killeen's website if you want to hear any of our programs. They're all there. 11 o'clock news in just a moment. When we come back, I'm going to talk to